Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 8th of July 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is actually episode number 43 in our series here. I never realised it would go on so long. There is just so much interesting history for us to have a look at, particularly in Britain, which is where we are centred at the moment. And of course, I do have with me today my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you, Sven?
Yeah, very good, very good. I'm looking forward into tonight's episode, actually. There's lots of interesting parts to it. We're going to be talking a little bit about Boadicea, the Boadician uprising, and if we've got time at the end, we might take a little look at the Siege of Jerusalem as well, which was prosecuted by Vespasian, because, of course, Vespasian was also the general that was prosecuting the war in Britain. So he was a formidable character that we fought against. And at the end of last week, of course, we talked about Caractacus and Caractacus's family and how they were really the first sort of Christian family in Britain, and the Palatium Britannicum, which became the first church in Rome. And now we're sort of moving into another section of British history, which is still quite well known, isn't it? Boadicea. I'm sure you've heard of Boadicea, Patriarch.
Vaguely. I'm not too familiar with the story, though. But vaguely familiar. So I'm interested to hear more.
It is. It's an interesting story. She's a great character. Queen Victoria was named after her.
Boadicea or Boadicea?
Both, either pronunciation, Boadicea, Boadicea.
Ah, right, yeah. Sorry, I've heard a lot more about Boadicea.
Yeah.
Is it Boadicea? Right, okay. I've always thought it was Boadicea.
Yeah, Boadicea. Yeah, probably your pronunciation is probably closer to the original one. Boadicea, right. I guess it's the Latinized version of it, and Boadicea would be the British version of it. And again, we're going to be reading from R.W. Morgan's book, The British Cymry. Well, he says, in AD 53, Nero, on the death of Claudius, succeeded on September the 28th to the throne. He remained for some time under the influence of Seneca, a Stoic philosopher in profession, but in practice, a grinding usurer. The capital of this man amounted to nearly £15 million worth of modern money, and this is writing in the 1800s. £2 million of this he advanced on the security of their public buildings to the Iceni tribe of Britain, being the first instance of a national loan on record. The king of the Iceni was Prasutagus, and his queen, Victoria, also known as Vudig, Budig, or Boadicea. And the wealth of Prasutagus was notorious at Rome. So we'll just stop there. And he says this is the first instance of a national loan on record. But we also know that the British did not engage in usury, neither did the Germanic tribes. It was not a British thing. And obviously the Romans had got involved in this. Don't know whether it originated with the Jews or not, but the Romans were definitely involved in usury. And this Seneca, he's made out to be this fantastic philosopher. They still talk about him today. I think he's actually looked upon as a saint by some of them in the church, but he was a usurer. He was an evil man. And I thought, well, we'll have a look in Wikipedia and see what Wikipedia has to say. Wikipedia says in 58 AD, the senator Publius Suilius Rufus made a series of public attacks on Seneca. These attacks, reported by Tacitus and Cassius Dio, included charges that in a mere 4 years of service to Nero, Seneca had acquired a vast personal fortune of 300 million sesterti by charging high interest on loans throughout Italy and the provinces. Seneca was undoubtedly extremely rich. He had properties at Bay and Nomentium, an Alban villa, and Egyptian estates. Cassius Dio even reports that the Boadicea uprising in Britannia was caused by Seneca forcing large loans on the indigenous British aristocracy in the aftermath of Claudius's conquest of Britain and then calling them in suddenly and aggressively. Seneca was sensitive to such accusations. In his De Vita Beata, or On the Happy Life, which dates from around this time, it includes a defence of wealth along Stoic lines, arguing that properly gaining and spending wealth is appropriate behaviour for a philosopher. So he thought he could get away with anything pretty much. But this shows us where R.W. Morgan is getting his information from. Cassius Dio, who is writing at the time. And also, of course, Tacitus wrote about Britain. So he's not just making up his information here. He's just putting it into modern language rather than Latin so that we can understand it. And also, Nero was a bit of a nutter, wasn't he? And he used to burn the Christians.
Yeah.
So we've gone from Claudius to Nero.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, did he accumulate much of his wealth through usury, or did he start off with a lot of wealth and usury was just a means by which he could kind of advance and perpetuate his wealth?
I'm not sure. I don't know, but they say that it was through usury that he made his wealth. So, I mean, he probably right. was an aristocrat in the first place. Probably brought up with money, but he didn't have to then use it in that way. I mean, usury basically takes advantage of the poor, doesn't it? I mean, what he's done here is he's encouraged the Iceni tribe to take out a loan when they don't need one because they've got sovereignty. They're part of a nation. They're a tribe. And he's done that on the security of their public buildings. And that also tells us that they had public buildings at the time. They can't have really been living in wooden shacks. They had to have had stone buildings for them to be a security, because you wouldn't take wooden shacks as a security for £2 million, would you?
And since it says he was so aggressive with recalling them, it's almost like a ploy in the first place just to secure any assets against their loans in the first place. So it's just a method of accumulating, isn't it?
Definitely. Really? Definitely. Yeah. I think that's what he was doing. He wanted to take a bit of Britain for himself. Arviragus, meanwhile, had been elected successor to Caradoc in the Pendragonate. Astorius was defeated by him at Carbelin near Carleon. Worn out in mind and body by the increasing difficulties of his position, Astorius shortly afterwards resigned the command to Didius Gallus and Gallus to Veranius, but neither proved equal to the task of coping with the British sovereign. The Roman armies were driven behind the Plotian lines, and Plotius was the previous general. Veranius was superseded by Suetonius Paulinus, a commander of a very different stamp, having among other able subordinates under him Julius Agricola. And I think I've heard of Julius Agricola before. I've heard of Suetonius Paulinus, but I think because of the battle that he has with Boadicea. But this shows you that the fortunes of the British and the Romans were continually fluctuating. You remember we talked about how this war pretty much went on for 40 years. So the Britons have actually pushed the Romans back behind their lines, and they're not very far into Britain. Basically, they're still around in the south. They're not in the north. In AD 57, Pomponia Gracchina, being publicly charged with the crime of Christianity, which under the Roman law was dealt with as treason, was proceeded against by order of Nero the Emperor, according to ancient institution, that is, before a court of her relatives presided over by her husband, and she was acquitted of all imputations affecting her life or honour. And Pomponia Gracchina, we spoke about last week, she was somehow related to Caractacus, and she was married to one of these Roman generals, I think Aulus Plotius, possibly, or Rufus, something or other. She's tied in with the Rufus that is mentioned in 2 Timothy. And she was charged with Christianity. So it's basically another piece of evidence to show that Christianity was in Britain at this time. This is
very true. But I guess it also demonstrates the stronghold that Roman Empire started to have on Britain, because that wouldn't have been within their typical laws at that time, because I thought, based on what we said learned earlier, that Britain tended to be quite open with religious different religions.
Good point. very good point there. So that also shows that that part of Britain was under Roman law. But she was married to a Roman, so she had to comply with Roman law. And I guess this is under Nero as well, who was very anti-Christian. He used to set fire to them, didn't he? That's what he was known for. And again, I looked up Wikipedia to see what Wikipedia has to say about this. Inscriptions in the catacombs of St. Callistus in Rome suggest that later members of Pomponia's family were indeed Christians. The archaeologist Battista de Rossi controversially identifies her with St. Lucina, the purported donor of the part of the catacombs where the inscriptions were found, and suggests that Lucina was Pomponia's baptismal name. Saint Lucina is honoured by the Roman Catholic Church on the 30th of June. She is said to have visited the martyrs Martinian and Processus, the two former guards at the Mamertine prison who had been converted in the prison by their prisoner Saint Peter, and who buried their bodies after their execution. So again, this is going back right to the few decades after Christ's resurrection and tying it in with Britain.
Was do we know if Gracina was actually a citizen of Britain, though? I mean, did she dwell there? Like, was she living there?
I think she was at a time, but she was also in Rome. I think this took place in Rome, where the trial took place. And she's called Gracina, they say, because she spoke Greek, because Gracina sort of implies that she was Greek, but she's tied in with the British royal family, Pomponia Gracina. Back to R.W. Morgan. In AD 60, the Boadicean War in the east of Britain was added to that which raged in the west under Arviragus. So the battle against Rome was all taking place in the west, in Cornwall and Devon, and the east has been pacified by the Romans, and the Iceni are a tributary tribe to Rome, and now we've got trouble that's happening there. The cause of it was as follows. Seneca, the capitalist, had, without due notice given, demanded immediate repayment of his loan to the Iceni with interest, charged at an exorbitant rate. On the Icenic Senate demurring to the rate of interest and requesting time to realise the necessary funds to discharge the principal, orders at the instigation of Seneca were sent by Nero to the Roman prefect to take possession of all the public temples, castles and palaces belonging to the state. The order was rigorously executed. A Roman force was marched upon Castor near Norwich and garrisons placed in the inferior fortresses. A few months subsequent to these peremptory measures, and whilst the Iceni were yet smarting under the sense of degradation, Prasutagus the king died, leaving by his will Nero co-heir with his two daughters to his accumulated treasures. On the pretext that the whole of this royal hoard came under the denomination of public property, Caius Decius proceeded to take possession of it. So I think what the king's done here is, by making Nero the heir, he's hoping that the Romans aren't just going to take his property, because they wouldn't take Nero's property. But they decide they're going to do that anyway. Resistance being made, the legionaries stormed the palace and perpetrated the most brutal outrages on the persons of Queen Boadicea and her two daughters, and carried off the treasures to the castle. Not content with the commission of these atrocities, Decius issued an edict confiscating, in direct violation of the Claudian Treaty, the estates of many of the Icenic nobility. So they're breaking the treaty that the Iceni had actually made with the Romans, and they also raped Boadicea and her two daughters. I mean, it was really savage what they did.
Really?
Yeah, wow. And that was the cause of this uprising. And then at the same time that orders had been dispatched to Decius, Suetonius Paulinus, who was stationed then at St. Albans, received instructions to extirpate Druidism at all hazards with the sword, and with this view to invade Mona or Anglesey, its chief seat in Cambria. So the Romans are really overstepping the mark here. I guess they must have got fed up with the continued battling in the West, and they've decided that Druidry may be the inspiration for these Britons. So they're going to go and destroy the holiest sanctuary to Druidry And at the same time, they've decided that they're just going to confiscate all the estates of the Iceni, which serves them right for being traitors, basically, and becoming subservient to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
But this destruction of Anglesey, I mean, that's quite a famous one, where they destroyed the groves in Anglesey. Have you heard of that one, Patriarch?
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, there was another one as well after St. Augustine in the 6th century. But this was the Roman one. The spirit of unbending patriotism, which has in all ages and against all invaders so nobly distinguished the Bardic Order of Britain, was an unpardonable crime in the eyes of an empire whose insatiable lust for territorial aggrandizement calumniated where it could not conquer and only spared where it could safely despise. So he's saying that the British patriotism was a crime in the eyes of Rome, and they could not stand to have this this patriotic people that were fighting against them. It also shows us the way that history books used to be written 150 years ago. The writers were filled with patriotism and nationalist sentiment, and they knew that their readers were as well. Mm-hmm. The instructions were executed with the ruthless thoroughness characteristic of the Roman service. By a succession of forced marches, Suetonius reached the Straits of the Minae. Here, on either side, extended the cemeteries of the ancient religion. Here reposed between the soaring ramparts of Mount Snowdon and the blue waves of an unexplored and boundless sea on the furthest vestige verge of the old world, chiefs whose ashes for 1,500 years had never been desecrated by the tramp above them of a foreign foe, arch-druids, the depositaries of the unwritten wisdom of the East, kings whose Cimbric names had carried terror to southern and far distant lands. Through these sanctuaries of so many and such ancient memories, the regulated march of the mailed legions of Rome now resounded. But behind them, a nation was rising up in arms. Whilst Druidic priest and priestess were being butchered on their own altars by the Roman sword, and the waters of the Minae were illuminated night and day by the glare of the conflagrations of the sacred groves, tens of thousands of Roman citizens were expiating with their lives the nefarious massacre. No sooner had the first intimation of the real nature of the expedition of Paulinus been made known than the war became a religious crusade. The Iceni and the Coronidae had so entirely forfeited the names of Britons that their oppression alone would have been regarded in the light of a just retribution. But the massacre of the Minae merged this feeling into one of universal indignation and horror. Offers of support poured in from all quarters, and Victoria soon found herself at the head of 120,000 men. So the two tribes that were being persecuted by the Romans here, they were both the traitor tribes. And if it had mm-hmm. just been that, it would have just been like, well, that's your just desserts. But because the Romans went and attacked the centre of Druidry, and all the priests and the holy men up in Anglesey, that was it. That sort of lit the touch paper and set the whole country on fire.
All right.
Okay. The Roman accounts impress us vividly with the deep gloom in which the Roman forces were plunged by a series of portents. The more interesting, as they are recorded in full faith by the pen of the philosophic historian Tacitus, who in the preceding page reproaches the Druidic religion as a sanguinary superstition. At Colchester, the statue of Victory, like that of Dagon at Joppa, fell backwards and was broken into fragments. A pythoness agitated as Cassandra on the eve of the fall of Troy, with the irrepressible spirit of divination, caused the streets to re-echo with her involuntary cry, "Death is at hand." In the Roman Senate House, the British war cry, uttered by invisible tongues, terrified and dispersed the councillors. The theatres resounded with the groans and wailings of a field of battle. In the waters of the Thames appeared the mirage of a Roman colony, subverted and in ruins, and the channel between Dover and Calais ran at high tide with blood. On the tide receding, the sands revealed in long lines the impressions of files of bodies, as if laid out for burial. So these are all the omens that were seen when this happened. And the Statue of Victory, I think that was a statue of Claudius that they erected at Colchester. So that fell over and collapsed and broke up. And this is being written by Tacitus just before the Romans attacked the Druids.
Right.
All of this happened. And he's likening it to at the fall of Troy. There's obviously a part in that where one of the priestesses at Delphi, one of the Pythonesses, gets all agitated and says what's happening. And the same thing's happened here. A Pythoness, which is at Delphi, which is where they have the oracle, where they'd have these women that would handle snakes, basically, and do the fortune-telling. She was saying death is at hand, and all these weird things happened, such as the channel running at high tide with blood. And it's Tacitus telling us this as well, the Roman historian. The Menai massacre had in fact no less terrified the consciences of its perpetrators than it had roused beyond control the religious fury of the British population. The deity, states Dion Cassius, predicted by these and other omens the magnitude of the impending disasters. The war was marked indeed by all the atrocities on both sides which have ever been the characteristics of religious crusades. The British army assembled at Carlisle, Leicester, under Venusius, and was harangued in person by Victoria. So the armies are basically lining up, getting ready to fight against the Romans, and Victoria gave a speech, Boadicea gave a speech, and we have a description of the speech and also of her person. The description of the person of the outraged queen by Cassius Dion is exceedingly interesting. He says, Boadicea mounted the general's tribunal. Her stature was of the largest, her appearance terrible, her aspect calm and collected, her voice deep and stern. Her hair fell as low as the hips in long golden tresses, collected around her forehead by a golden coronet. She wore a tartan dress fitting closely to the bosom, but below the waist opening in loose folds as a gown. Over it was a chamois or military cloak. This was her usual attire, and on this occasion she also carried a spear. And you've probably seen the statue of this, a picture of Boadicea with her spear on the chariot. It's quite a famous picture with horses.
With her daughters.
Yeah, might well have the daughters there as well. I mean, it's a very, very famous patriotic British emblem, is Boadicea leading the uprising against the Romans.
There's a statue in London, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. That's the one I'm thinking of. And that was designed from this description that we have of her. And this is how women would have looked back then, or at least this is how the queen looked, with a tartan dress, long hair, and a coronet. Her prayer to Andrastae, the British goddess of victory, will give a fair idea of the spirit and tenor of her address. I thank thee, I worship thee, I appeal to thee, a woman to a woman, O Andrastae. I rule not like Nitocris over beasts of burden, as are the effeminate nations of the East, nor like Semiramis over mere tradesmen and traffickers like the Egyptians, nor like the man-woman Nero over slaves and eunuchs. Such is the precious literature these Romans would introduce amongst us. But I rule over Britons, little skilled indeed in craft and policy, but born and trained to the game of war. Men who in the cause of liberty stake down their own lives, the lives of their wives and children, their lands and property. Queen of such a race, I implore thine aid for freedom, for victory over enemies infamous for the wantonness of the wrongs they inflict, for their perversion of justice, for their contempt of religion, for their insatiable greed. But a people also that revel in unmanly pleasures, that cannot live without luxurious dishes or sleep except on beds of down, whose affections are more to be dreaded and abhorred than their wars. Never let a foreigner bear rule over me or these my countrymen. Never let slavery reign in this isle. Its proper home is Rome. Be thou alone forever, O goddess of manhood and of victory, sovereign and queen in Britain. Now, there's loads there, isn't there, that
we can get into. Yeah, it's very insightful to the nature of the, essentially the two cultures at war, really. And it's almost kind of similar to the West and the East, Western Europe and Eastern Europe today, isn't it, in some ways? You know, how what the West has become in terms of very worldly and, you know, from a Christian perspective, you know, to the, or the desires of the flesh and a lot of, you know, moral statutes out the window.
Oh, completely. I mean, it is very similar, isn't it? I mean, that's what she's saying, that the Romans bring in literature which causes men to become effeminate and to engage in unmanly pleasures. And she says that Nero rules over slaves and eunuchs, and Semiramis over tradesmen and traffickers, like the Egyptians. Semiramis was Babylon. That was one of the goddesses from Babylon. So she's talking about the East, and obviously she's not talking about Arabs or Indians, the people that are over there now. She's talking about the white people that were over there, that was a part of the Roman Empire. And she talks about the race, the British race. And of course, you know, that's what race meant back then. It meant the same thing as nation means today.
We didn't Ethnos really. Ethnos is the Greek, isn't it?
Yeah. And never let a foreigner bear rule over me or these my countrymen. I mean, it's a really patriotic speech. And it says about the Romans, their perversion of justice and their contempt of religion. So they put the price up on the usury, which is a perversion of justice anyway, and then their contempt of religion by attacking the Druids. But also they've obviously been subverting the manhood of the nation somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder as well what state Britain would have been in at the time. They must have had certain strongholds, and if you think over the span of decades of war, it's kind of like they would have come to a point where they're kind of a bit more content to just, you know, let them have that territory and we'll stick here so long as we've got a bit of peace and there's a bit of downtime, you know, and it obviously reached a breaking point whereby, you know, that, you know, what happened, and then it just riled everyone up and it was like, you know, let's put an end to this altogether.
Well, the Iceni and the Coronidae thought they were going to have it easy because, that you know, they'd already submitted to Rome. And they thought they were going to have it easy, but they were really badly treated, it seems here. I'm also interested what the literature was, the precious literature the Romans would introduce amongst them. She says would have turned the British people into slaves and eunuchs and tradesmen and traffickers like the Egyptians. And she calls Nero a man woman, so perhaps Nero was transgender. I mean, that was a big insult back then, was to say somebody was effeminate. And yet, the Romans used to have eunuchs. Remember, there was that eunuch that harangued the Roman army to get them to come and fight in Britain because the Roman army didn't want to come and fight. And that was Nero's favourite servant, was this eunuch. And these are the sort of things that were just completely out of bounds in Britain to even think of having these things. So it does show you that the Romans were quite corrupt and perverse.
I think, that was probably, I mean, how far into the Roman Empire is this, are we talking?
I think, well, Julius Caesar, that was when the empire started, wasn't it? So probably no more than 100 years.
100 years into the Roman Empire.
Yeah, since the empire, because it was a republic before that, wasn't it? And Julius Caesar was the first Caesar. And he was fighting against the Britons, I think, 50 BC. And what we're talking about here is 55 BC. So it's been an empire for 100 years by this time.
Okay, so there's still a long way to go, really, in its lifespan, right, of Rome, how long it lasted. So I would have thought that might have been its downfall, but obviously it wasn't.
Decadence became its downfall. Decadence and multiculturalism And all the yeah. things that weaken a state and that weaken a nation, that's what became its downfall, I think.
But the decadence was evident here at this point in time.
Yeah.
And so it must have been that they must have gone on a number of centuries still like this, though, throughout the rest of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, it must have been going downhill, because it was picked up again by Constantine in the 3rd century with Christianity, and then it split into the East and the Western Roman Empire.
Right, okay. So then it got a resurgence from the morality that kind of a lot of the corruption may have been cleaned out, and a different type of corruption, maybe more so through the Roman Catholic Church as opposed to just the paganism.
Well, there's also the Germanic tribes that went into North Africa, and they were disgusted at what they saw, and prostitution and all sorts was going on, and they banned it all and made it all illegal. And again, they took over, and they were able to reinvigorate the morals of the place.
Right.
Because the Romans had become very, very decadent. I mean, that's what they say, isn't it? Hard times create strong men create good times mm-hmm. create weak men. And that's what you've yeah. got here. You've got leadership like Nero, leadership like Caligula. Terrible.
It's the same with, it definitely becomes a downfall for any man, really. I believe that was one of the downfalls for Alexander the Great towards the end of his reign. When they stopped expanding, he started to spend a lot more time in Babylonia, and I know he was very fond of all the fine attire and things, and I think that's when he let his guard down, and he was apparently poisoned, wasn't he?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why we had a monarchy, so people were born into wealth, and mm. they didn't get there through insatiable greed. You know, they were born into it, so they sort of took it for granted, and then they would be taught to sympathize with the common man through corporal punishment and things like that, or that's how it developed. But I think that's one of the reasons why we had monarchy, to prevent corruption and to prevent people from getting to those positions where they're going to rule over people just for themselves, rather than putting the nation first. You know, there's a lot of, you never hear about the positives of monarchy, do you? It's always democracy
really.
Promotion. Oh yeah, well it's great that we have a queen, and but it's even better that she's a constitutional monarch. And you'll never hear people saying, you know, what was good about monarchy. And yet we had it for thousands of years, and that was the Christian system that we were given, was monarchy, and there's good reasons for it, I think.
I'd never thought of it like that as a benefit, really. I was listening to a podcast today, actually. I think it was Bill Fink, and he was talking about, it was an old one, and he was talking about wealth, and, you know, people that are given good wealth in life, obviously all comes from God, and you're blessed with good wealth, but ultimately it's a test of what you do with that wealth and that position of power, really. I mean, everyone's in a position where they're tested differently, and those with money should you know, use their wealth to help their brethren.
Well, that's the Christian teaching, isn't it? Noblesse oblige.
Mm-hmm.
If you have wealth, then you're obliged to help the poor, and that's why you have the wealth, and that's a good system to have. But again, if you have diversity and multiculturalism, and you have other peoples within your kingdom, and you lavish your wealth upon them, that wealth is not going to stay within your kingdom, is it? It's then going to go out to the foreign families and the extended families of the foreign people that you've given it to. Because it also says in the Bible, cast your bread upon the waters so that it may come back to you. But if you cast your bread onto foreign waters, it's never going to come back to you. So it's charity sort of begins at home. But there was this thing, noblesse oblige, which meant that if you were part of the aristocracy, you were obliged to think of those that were less well off than you, and to see them as a necessary thing. They needed to be there so that you could be charitable, so that you could be merciful, so that you could help people out. And because only a certain number of people can help people out, only the ones that have can help those that have not, and give them a help up in life. So they were seen as a necessary evil, the poor. Mm-hmm. So that the rich had somebody to help out. Otherwise, you know, what chance would the rich have to demonstrate their virtue if there wasn't any poor there? And this was the sort of way that things were looked at. So we project the way that we think today back onto the past, and we would think, oh, well, these rich people, these lords, and they must have oppressed the poor. But I don't think they did. And I certainly don't think the king oppressed his subjects, because a king couldn't be a king without his people. They were the most important thing, more important than land. And when you think about it, you know, you might get the old bad king, but we've had more than one good king that's remembered. I can't think of any particularly good prime ministers, but I can think of lots of good kings. There's lots of kings who have the name the Great after them.
Yeah, you might
always get
true.
A bad one, but you're going to, on the whole, it's generally a good system to have. But getting back to what's happening here in Britain, Colchester was carried on the first assault by the British army. The temple garrisoned by the veterans held out for 2 days and then shared the same fate. Petilius Cerealis, the Roman lieutenant, was defeated with the loss of the whole of the 9th Legion at Cogia Hall or Cogi Collis. Cerealis himself, with a few horsemen, escaped into camp. The municipal town of Verulam was in the same manner stormed, gutted and burned. London, during the protracted absence of Arviragus in the west, had once again failed in its allegiance and received a Roman garrison under the name of a colony within its walls. Its commerce at this period was so extensive that the Roman citizens alone resident in it were estimated at 50,000. If we calculate these at so high as a sixth part of its whole population, we have a strong, though undesigned, confirmation of the extreme antiquity assigned by the British historians to the founder and splendour of the British capital. Against it, the British army now swelled to 230,000 men, directed its vengeance. So he's saying if we have 50,000 Roman soldiers there, then the population must have been 300,000. And to have 300,000 men in a city, it cannot have just been started as a colony by the Romans. It had to have been an established capital city for some centuries to have that many people there living within it. So, you know, because they'll tell you today, London was started by the Romans as a colony. And yet this recording here that tells us there were 50,000 Roman citizens resident in it shows that cannot be true. And it's the British historians that are telling the truth, or the early British historians, of course, because modern British historians will just repeat the modern politically correct history.
Yeah, well, Britain was founded by, was it Brutus? And he was they called it this New Troy.
Yeah, New Troy. And that's why the tribe that were there were called the Trinovantes.
Yeah,
although
they were kind of the same people in origin, originally, like Brutus was kind of from around that similar region, right?
Brutus was from Troy.
Troy, okay.
Asia Minor, so sort of Asia Minor area. And our histories tell us that before that we had people coming over here from Phoenicia, Princess Albion, from Syria, from Syria area. I at this time, that was part of Europe. Constantinople was part of Europe. It wasn't part of Turkey. It was part of Europe there. Where do we get to here? The battle in London. Such of the inhabitants as possessed the means fled at its approach. The rest, including the Roman citizens and the foreign merchants, took refuge with the garrison in the ramparts extending from the Temple of Diana to the White Mount. And remember, that Temple of Diana was the one that was built by Brutus. The ramparts were escalated, the city fired in four different quarters, public buildings and private residences reduced alike to ashes. No quarter or ransom, states Tacitus, was given or taken on either side in this war. It is difficult to conjecture how many lives were sacrificed in this act of national justice. Tacitus implies that before the engagement with Paulinus, more than 70,000 Romans had fallen, either in garrison or in the field. It is worthy of remark that the only time London has been rifled and destroyed has been not by a foreign enemy, but by a British Queen and a British army, visiting it with condign punishment for its collusion with a foreign invader. The lesson appears never to have been forgotten, for its citizens have ever since been the first to repel the open attacks or insidious influences of foreign powers. Would that it still were so. Remember, this was being written in the 19th century, 18th century this was being written, about 1870. Mm-hmm. This was written at the time. And the Trinovantes were the tribe that were in London, but the Trinovantes had been moved up out of London, and they were then in the north. And it was the Coronidae and the Iceni that were the traitors. But Boadicea was actually the queen of the Iceni. It was the Iceni that, I think it might have even been the Iceni that handed Caractacus over. One of the two.
So then Boadicea was colluding with Rome?
Her father was, Prasutagus, yes. That's why they got the loans from Seneca and the Iceni were. And then when Seneca called his loans in and Prasutagus died, the Romans took all the buildings and said, well, now we own all these buildings and we're going to take in that loan as well, and we want all the principal and we want all the interest and we want it all now, and we're also going to rape you and your daughters. Oh, and, yeah. And by the way, we're going to destroy the Druid stronghold in Anglesey as well. So that's essentially what the Romans did. They didn't reward the traitors, did they?
No, I guess not.
And I guess the traitors redeemed themselves by leading the uprising.
But there must have been a lot of the traitors which turned on them, and that might have reunited, parts of Britain at the time. So the Iceni, they must have been indifferent to the rest of their, kindred. This may have been something which kind of united them.
Well, it does show that blood is thicker than water, doesn't it? I mean, you got these traitorous tribes, and yet when you're facing against the same enemy and an indignity like attacking the national religion and killing all the priests, then, you know, this argument about being traitors goes out the window, and they all unite and fight against the Romans. So it shows that blood is thicker than water, really. Leaving this terrible example of a metropolis smouldering in ashes, quenched with the blood of its inhabitants behind, Victoria swept westwards with her forces. Tacitus records but two, but Dion many engagements between her and the Roman general. Her epithet in the British chronicles, Vudig or Victoria, implies that in not a few of these, success attended her arms. So he's saying this is why she has the name Victoria, because she was victorious in these battles. Tacitus fixes the last battle on the edge of Epping Forest. The Greek historian and the British traditions on the Guadalian Road near Newmarket in Flintshire. The various names at this latter site express so correctly the incidents of the battle that we may almost imagine Dion Cassius examining the ground prior to writing his description. Here we find Cop Paulinus, the Hill of Arrows, the Hill of the Carnage, the Hollow of Woe, the Knoll of the Melee, the Hollow of Execution, the Field of the Tribunal, and the Hollow of No Quarter. So this area that the British people say this is where the battle took place, it's got lots of areas named after the battle, and yet the historians today will say, oh no, it was on the edge of Epping Forest. They just ignore the British traditions. I think I've been up near there. I remember going somewhere called Gop Paulinus, which was just like a mound, and it's got a little plaque there that says something about this being the final site of the battle against Boadicea. Up in North Wales. Half a mile distant is the memorial stone termed the Stone of Lamentation, and on the road to Carwis was formerly, now removed to Downing Street, the stone of the grave of Budig, or Victoria's tomb. So that's interesting. The memorial stone is now at Downing Street. I'd like to have a look at that. It was apparently on the road before. Turning to the pages of Dion, we find the conflict to have been just what these names suggest and perpetuate, a deadly melee of heavily armed legionaries, auxiliaries, archers, cavalry and charioteers mingled together and swaying to and fro in all the heady currents of a desperate fight over the whole extent of the ground. The fortune of the day towards sunset inclined to the Romans. The Britons were driven back within their entrenchments, leaving a large number of dead on the field or as prisoners in the hands of the enemy. The rest retired in good order and prepared shortly afterwards to renew the conflict. In the interim, however, Victoria died, according to Tacitus by poison, and according to Dion, in the course of nature. So we don't actually know how she died, but we do know that she died after this battle. She was buried with profuse magnificence. The death of Victoria, or as she is generally designated, Boadicea or Boudica, affected little the resources or spirit of the Cymry of the West. Under Arviragus, Venusius, Galgacus ap Llynog, Prince of the Strathclyde Britons, the war was continued with unabated vigour. The name of Arviragus had attained at Rome a celebrity equal to that of his cousin Caradoc, nor could Juvenal suggest any news which would have been hailed with more intense satisfaction than that of the fall of this indomitable Pendragon. Has our great enemy Arviragus, the car-born British king, dropped from his battle throne? Perox Provincia, an untamable province, is the name applied by the Latin historians to our island at this period. The Silurians, especially, states Tacitus, could neither be coerced by any measures, however sanguinary, nor bribed by any promises, however brilliant, to acknowledge the dominion of Rome. So there's a number of quotes there that he's quoting from these Latin authors, calling Britain Perox Provincia, the untamable province, and the Britons are refusing to be bribed. Harassed by the same anxieties that had undermined the constitution of Ostorius Scapula, Paulinus, at the expiration of AD 60, resigned in favour of Petronius Turpilianus. The whole of the Roman Empire elsewhere enjoyed tranquillity, Syria alone excepted, the disturbances in which were pacified that same year by Corbulo. It is to be noted that whatever emperor occupied the throne, the empire itself was never deficient in statesmen and generals of the highest order of ability. The genius of the world, from the Euphrates to Gibraltar, and from Calais to the Sahara, was at its command, and ready to be employed with unswerving purpose for the incorporation of Britain. In AD 64, the extinction of Druidism in the territories south of the Thames and in those of the Coritani and Iceni was completed by Turpilianus. The first persecution of the Christians by Nero took place in the same year. In AD 65, Turpilianus was succeeded by Trebulia Maximus. Under his command, the Roman frontiers receded to the district between Devon and Dover. Maximus was recalled and Vectius Bolanus appointed, but with no better success. In AD 66, Linus, the second son of Caractacus, was consecrated by St. Paul as Bishop of Rome. In AD 67, St. Paul and St. Peter suffered martyrdom at Rome, and St. Paul was buried in the Ostian Way. The four children of Claudia were in after years buried by his side. In June AD 68, Nero was succeeded by Galba. The year of revolutions, AD 69, was long remembered for the rapid changes in the occupation of the imperial throne, Galba being succeeded by Otho, Otho by Vitellius, and Vitellius by Vespasian, remember the Roman general that first started prosecuting the war in Britain. Titus, in AD 70, captured and razed Jerusalem to the ground, 1,100,000 Jews being slain in the siege or having perished from famine. An armistice was concluded with Arviragus by Petilius Cerealis, apparently with no other view than to enable Vespasian to boast that during his reign the Temple of Janus was shut for the sixth time since the foundation of Rome, BC 753, a mournful comment on the history of man. and his empires. And that that sort of finishes up with the British section that I wanted to do this week. So, that was the whole might of Rome, basically, that was fighting against Britain. And they were continually rotating the generals that they had here. And we didn't have the benefit of doing that. We didn't have the benefit of doing that.
I think they obviously had the away disadvantage, but they had unlimited resource almost, didn't they? And Britain obviously was at home on home soil, but also it would have been, they're limited in resource, so it would have been, I think that's why it probably lasted so long, because it was almost equaled out in terms of its advantages and disadvantages by the side.
I think the religion obviously played an important part. Otherwise, they would not have gone after the Druids. They wouldn't have gone and, destroyed Menai. I mean, that shows you the power of having a religion that unites the nation can have.
Mm-hmm.
Because these fighters didn't mind dying, and it was with a religious fervor that they were fighting against the Romans. So the Romans thought, well, if we take out their religion, then their spirit will be gone. And they'll be much easier to defeat.
Do we know when essentially the Druid religion kind of became a thing of the past? Like it was quashed. I guess that was down to Christianity, wasn't it? It was almost dissolved.
It changed into Christianity in about 150 AD. We'll get to it when the king, by unanimous consent of the Britons, changed the religion from Druidry to Christianity. It was probably at about 100 years away from this, or 80 years away from now. So I guess Druidry would have been weakened, but I mean, it was the main centre of it in Menai that they basically wiped it out, and they wiped it out in London and in the east. But they weren't able to in the west, and obviously there was still Druidic centres in the Midlands and in the north. It was just that the main one in Wales had been wiped out. But then the Druids became Christians anyway in 80 years' time. But there were still vestiges of Druidry. It wasn't like everything suddenly changed and the religion was completely different. It was more like an evolution from Druidry into Christianity with the same structures that were in place afterwards, the same systems.
Yeah. So let's just kind of put it in perspective. Around that time, you would have had some of the early Christians within the British Isles. You'd have had the main religion, which was Druidism, and then you would have had the Romans, which were coming in, and obviously they were pagan.
The Romans were worshipping Caesar, weren't they? And they were worshipping statues and all sorts of silly things that was mocked by the British.
But Christianity was still there in its infancy, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Bran the Blessed, Caractacus's father, was, I mean, he's the first one that's named with a Christian name, Bran the Blessed. That's why he's given that name. And it was Caractacus's family that came back to Britain and gave Joseph of Arimathea's men the help that they needed for it to really sort of take off in Britain. But as I said, I wanted to have a little look at the fall of Jerusalem, because this happened at the same time. And I'll use Wikipedia for this, because it just seems very similar to me to the sort of revolutions that took place last century, particularly the one in Russia. And most of the information about the fall of Jerusalem and the Judean Wars, it comes from Flavius Josephus, and I cannot recommend reading Flavius Josephus's work enough. I've read his complete works twice. It does take a long time to read, and it'd probably take you a year to read it. But it is so informative and enlightening to read. It really is.
Yeah.
You get an idea of what white people used to be like 2,000 years ago, the morals that they used to have, the sense of honour that they used to have. Plus, you also get an idea of how Rome used to work, how the empire used to work. You get an idea of the religion that there was there in Judea, how important the temple was, how there were people from all over the world that came to that temple. It wasn't just Jews that went to that temple. They had a separate bit for the nations, and the nations would go there and offer up sacrifices. And it has all information on how certain parts of the Bible were interpreted. It's just fascinating stuff to read. And it just seems very clear to me. Flavius Josephus is, you know, he's a white man. He talks about his pedigree, and he talks about Herod and the Edomites, which eventually basically became known as the Jews. The tribe of Benjamin.
Modern.
Yeah, the tribe of Benjamin became Christian. All of Jesus's followers were of the tribe of Benjamin from Galilee, apart from Judas Iscariot. And the Benjamites became Christian, and the Edomites came out with rabbinic Judaism after Christ. Yeah. And also the Benjamites, the Christians, the Galileans, because they were referred to as the Galileans at the time, as opposed to the Jews. You had the Jews and the Galileans. The Galileans actually left Jerusalem before the battles started, because they had a prophecy and they left. And the Jews were all left there at Jerusalem, along with all these other vagabonds. As I say, Wikipedia does give us a timeline here, which I'll read out. On the 14th of April, 70 AD, 3 days before the Passover, the Roman army started besieging Jerusalem. The city had been taken over by several rebel factions following a period of massive unrest and the collapse of a short-lived provisional government. Within 3 weeks, the Roman army broke the first two walls of the city, but a stubborn rebel standoff prevented them from penetrating the thickest and the third wall. According to Josephus, a contemporary historian and the main source for the war, the city was ravaged by murder, famine, and cannibalism. And that just reminds me of what went on in the Ukraine. You know, the mass starvation, the deliberate starvation, and the cannibalism that went on. Because this famine was deliberate. Josephus wrote that over 1 million people perished in the siege and the subsequent fighting. While contemporary studies dispute this figure, all agree that the siege had a major toll on human life, with many people being killed and enslaved, and large parts of the city destroyed. The Jewish defenders were split into factions. Simon bar Giora and John of Giscala, the two prominent zealot leaders, placed all the blame for the failure of their revolt on the shoulders of the moderate leadership. John of Giscala's group murdered another faction leader, Eleazar ben Simon, whose men were entrenched in the forecourts of the temple. The zealots resolved to prevent the city from falling into Roman hands by all means necessary, which included the murder of political opponents and anyone standing in their way. So this is interesting to me. They blame the moderate leadership, so they're accelerationists. They want to accelerate things. And they think the way to defeat the Romans is to murder all their political opponents and just get rid of them. I mean, it's just like Stalin and the Bolsheviks, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
There were still those wishing to negotiate with the Romans and bring a peaceful end to the siege. The most prominent of these was Yohanan ben Zaki, whose students smuggled him out of the city in a coffin in order to deal with Vespasian. This, however, was insufficient to deal with the madness that had now gripped the zealot leadership in Jerusalem and the reign of terror it unleashed upon the population of the city. Remember, that's the zealot leadership, that's the Jewish leadership unleashing a reign of terror on its own city. Josephus describes various acts of savagery committed against the people by its own leadership, including the torching of the city's food supply in an apparent bid to force the defenders to fight for their lives. Despite early successes in repelling the Roman sieges, the zealots fought amongst themselves and they lacked proper leadership, resulting in poor discipline, training and preparation for the battles that were to follow. At one point, they destroyed the food stocks in the city, a drastic measure, thought to have been undertaken, perhaps, in order to enlist a merciful God's intervention on behalf of the besieged Jews, or as a stratagem to make the defenders more desperate, supposing that that was necessary in order to repel the Roman army. Do they say an army marches on an empty stomach? Isn't that a saying, something to do with an empty stomach?
Possibly. I mean, it's marches on its stomach. Keeping the men hungry.
Yeah, well, that's what they did. They thought, well, we'll just starve the population and then they'll be really mad and they'll fight against the Romans more. They were absolutely insane. I mean, if I recall correctly, they were dressing up as women as well. and doing this and just doing absolutely insane things. And it's like the depravity and madness that man can actually come to is all described in Josephus' history of what went on in Jerusalem with the war against the Romans.
A lot of this kind of seems reminiscent of today, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, even here today, a lot of food supplies and factories actually being burnt to a cinder. You know, farmers being told not to farm anymore. And the wife was telling me today in Romania, the farmers, they're ready to reap the heart, but they haven't got any storage anymore because of the grain from Ukraine has been basically taken and put in Romania, basically occupying the space there. So, you know, it's only going to lead to more shortages, and there's a lot of stuff going off around the world today, which is kind of all pointing towards, you know, affecting the overall food supply.
And deliberately doing it, isn't it? Yeah, these factories, great big food storage facilities going up in flames in America. As you're saying there, all the grain being held in Romanian silos, the Ukrainian grain, which is needed for Africa. The Romanians can't put the grain in their own silos, that means. And it means the Ukrainian grain isn't going to Africa. And it's been deliberately done, like a deliberate starvation. Well, obviously the temple was the most important part of this. Overlooking the temple compound, the fortress provided a perfect point from which to attack the temple itself. Although destroying the temple was not among Titus's goals, possibly due in large part to the massive expansions carried out by Herod, the so-called Great, mere decades earlier. And I do find it interesting that historians refer to Herod as Herod the Great. I mean, he's Herod the baby killer. And he was not a liked man, but for some reason they refer to him as Herod the Great. And this is what Wikipedia has to say about Herod. King Herod ruled Jerusalem from 37 BC to 4 BC as a vassal king for the Roman Empire, having been appointed King of the Jews by the Roman Senate. Herod the Great was known as a tyrant, mostly because of his campaign to kill anyone who could claim the throne. That's anybody who could claim the throne. That's anybody who was from the tribe of Judah, because the tribe of Judah was the royal tribe. So he wanted to kill anyone that was actually from Judah. Herod had all relatives of the previous dynasty, the Hasmonean dynasty, executed. This included his wife, the daughter of the Hasmonean king, and all of her family members. So he married the daughter of the Judahite king and then took the kingship for himself. Herod also created a new line of nobility that would have loyalties to only him, known as the Herodians. He appointed new high priests from families that were not connected to the past dynasty. And of course, the high priests are all supposed to come from the tribe of Levi. So he's appointed people to the priesthood from his own tribe, from the Edomites. After Herod's death, several relatives made claims to the region, beginning with the Herodian Tetrarchy. So although Wikipedia is not explicit here, this confirms what we talk about Herod being an Edomite and Herod replacing all the aristocracy with other Edomites and getting rid of all the Israelites. And that's effectively what it's telling us here.
And when you know, if you understand the Old Testament and the setup of how things, the natural order of things, how they were, you can understand that it was became ultimately a perversion. And that's mostly why Christ kind of rejected them and rebuked them. Essentially proselytes, weren't they? Converts that didn't have a place in the temple.
Proselytes of the gate, proselytes of justice. But also Herod rebuilt the temple. So you think Herod, this wicked man who's not an Israelite, and he rebuilds the temple in how he wants the temple to be. And the temple's supposed to be holy. So this is one of the reasons why it was destroyed. Josephus's account absolves Titus, that's the Roman general, of any culpability for the destruction of the temple. And the account of Josephus described Titus as moderate in his approach, and after conferring with others, ordering that the 500-year-old temple be spared. According to Josephus, it was the Jews who first used fire in the northwest approach to the temple to try and stop the Roman advance. Only then did Roman soldiers set fire to an apartment adjacent to the temple, starting a conflagration which the Jews subsequently made worse. The fire spread quickly and was soon out of control, and the temple was captured and destroyed on 9th or 10th Tisha B'Av, which is sometime in August 70 AD, and the flames spread into the residential sections of the city. Josephus actually tells us that the Romans had tears in their eyes when they saw this temple going up. They had tears in their eyes because it was such a marvel of architecture. And the Jews were just insane. They were pouring oil on the fire. The destruction of Jerusalem and the Second Temple marked a major turning point in Jewish history. The loss of the mother city and the temple necessitated a reshaping of Jewish culture to ensure its survival. A form of Judaism that became known as Rabbinic Judaism developed and eventually became the mainstream form of the religion. The followers of Jesus of Nazareth also survived the city's destruction. They spread his teaching across the Roman Empire, giving rise to the new religion of Christianity. Of course, I would say that the Old Testament religion shouldn't really be called Judaism. It's the Rabbinic Judaism that we know today. That's what we should call Judaism. And what they had before that, the religion that was there in the Old Testament, that became Christianity. And the people that had become Christian were warned that this is what was going to happen. And there was a prophecy, and it said, when you see such and such and such and such happening, run for the hills. And they did, which is why the Christians spread, and the Jews ended up being this tiny minority.
But, I think the reason it was called Judaism, because Judah was the kind of the remaining tribe which kind of continued the traditions, although it became corrupt. It probably became synonymous with Judah, as there's the Judaic kingdom. So that's why it became Judaism, but obviously then that just name carried, didn't it?
Oh yeah, after Judea, because the country didn't used to be called Judea. It was called Judea by the Romans, and then the religion would have been known as Judaism, I guess. And you had citizens of Judea, and then the Galileans, the Benjaminites, the ones that were actually Israelites, they became Christian, and the followers of Herod, they came out with Rabbinic Judaism. Once the temple was gone.
Just a thought. It said King Jared ruled Jerusalem from 37 BC to 4 BC.
Yeah, it was his descendants were the one that was around after Jesus. There was one of his sons, one of the Herodian Tetrarchy. They're all evil people.
Right.
But the main one was Herod the Great. He was the worst one.
Right, but it was all Herod.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, they're all called Herod. Basically, and his followers are called Herodians. And now I've got a quote here, which is a direct quote from Josephus, and this is quite illuminating as well. He says, "Now, as soon as the army had no more people to slay or to plunder, because there remained none to be the objects of their fury, for they would not have spared any, had there remained any other work to be done, Titus Caesar gave orders that they should now demolish the entire city and the temple, but should leave as many of the towers standing as they were of the greatest eminence, that is, Phaselus and Hippicus and Mariamne, and so much of the wall enclosed the city on the west side. This wall was spared in order to afford a camp for such as were to lie in garrison in the upper city, as were the towers, the three forts also spared, in order to demonstrate to posterity what kind of city it was, and how well fortified, which the Roman valour had subdued. But for all the rest of the wall surrounding Jerusalem, it was so thoroughly laid even with the ground by those that dug it up to the foundation, that there was left nothing to make those that came thither believe that it, Jerusalem, had ever even been inhabited. This was the end which Jerusalem came to by the madness of those that were for innovations, a city otherwise of great magnificence and of mighty fame among all mankind. And truly, the very view itself was a melancholy thing, for those places which were adorned with trees and pleasant gardens were now become desolate country every way, and its trees were all cut down. Nor could any foreigner that had formerly seen Judea and the most beautiful suburbs of the city, and now saw it as a desert, but lament and mourn sadly at so great a change. For the war had laid all signs of beauty quite waste. nor had anyone who had known the place before had come on a sudden to it now, would he have known it again. For though he, a foreigner, were at the city itself, yet would he have inquired for it. So it tells us that this was an ancient city. It was a great city. It was an absolutely beautiful city. And it was absolutely, utterly destroyed by the Romans. Destroyed so much that they actually cut down every tree. Every single tree that you could see, they cut down. And they used the trees for the siege engines. And this is why it's a desert now. That's why Jerusalem is a desert. It didn't used to be a desert, as it says here. It used to be all gardens, used to be lush, used to be all fertile. And the Romans cut all the trees down to make siege engines to fight against these Jews because the Jews went crazy. I mean, that's what Josephus is saying here. The madness of those that were for innovations. And what he means by that is rebellion, revolution. They wanted to revolt against the Romans. They didn't want to go along with civilization. They wanted a revolution. And that's what happens to revolutions. You always end up being worse off if you have a violent revolution. And that's a lesson of history, I think. You got any thoughts on any of that, Patriarch?
It's quite insightful. The last bit's... trying to think, really. I guess it's just it was all kind of prophesied, wasn't it? From the Old Testament and to even what Christ said. It kind of happened right after Christ as well. They would have thought that, the Christians probably would have thought that Christ's return was kind of imminent right after. They expected to be coming back sooner than later. But yeah, pretty much what he said.
They were warned. They were warned. When you see this happening, you need to get out, flee for the hills, which the Christians did. It's I wish I'd actually done a few podcasts on the Judean War as I was reading the book. I wish it was fresh in my mind because I've had to take these notes from Wikipedia, and I just remember there was so much more than that actually goes on in it. But it would take me so long to go through the book and try and find some sections of it and to read them out. They're very long sections. So all I can do is just encourage the listeners to have a read of Flavius Josephus's Histories of Judea, if they can. It really is worth it. It's one of the great classics of all time. You know, it's up there with the Bible, the works of Flavius Josephus. Anyway, I think we'll leave it there for today, Patriarch. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. Insightful as always.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.